right here is for the people.
Now, welcome to podcast 35. So the Renaissance podcasts have changed in direction and flavour throughout our evolution. And one of the key turning points for me, or the catalyst, if you like, is the Action for Happiness group. We've spoken about it several times in previous episodes, but it's following an Action for Happiness event that my co-host Anne and I attended that I was introduced to the idea of mindfulness. I didn't understand what it meant, nor did I appreciate the positive effect that it would have on my life. Given that this is a subject that's backed with science, and there's unending anecdotal evidence, the Renaissance team has had to update its mission statement. Our understanding of what happiness is varies from culture to culture and person to person. However, with this help of science, we're getting closer to understanding what this means, and also what it isn't. I was fortunate enough to get some time with the Action for Happiness director, Dr. Mark Williamson, over a beer, following a talk that he gave in late 2014. This great conversation has led to this podcast. So, first of all, Mark, thank you very much for joining.
My pleasure. Very nice to be here.
We also have the full Renaissance team in the house, Anne and Fran.
Hello.
Hey.
All who now meditate daily. Well, almost daily. And with this tight-knit group of friends and co-hosts, it's been great to share our stories and watch each other grow and have these podcasts recorded, because it really does track this evolution. So thank you very much, guys. So Mark, if I may, you've been a director for the Action for Happiness group since October 2010. Mm. And prior to this, you've got an amazing resume of education with an MBA from IMD Business School. You hold a PhD and first-class honours degree in electronics and communications from Bristol Uni, a Sainsbury's Management Fellow and Chartered Engineer. You spent 9 years as a management consultant at Accenture, and before this worked for HP Labs and Orange. And then there's this amazing paradigm-shifting move that takes place, and you join the team for Action for Happiness. So Mark, perhaps we can begin with your story. If you can tell us what the Action for Happiness group is and how it came about and how you became involved.
Certainly. Well, gosh, first of all, it sounds rather exhausting hearing my own resume played back like that. Well, you said start with my story, so I might start a little bit before Action for Happiness, actually, because as you've just sort of laid out, my background is perhaps not one you'd expect for someone who's ended up running a kind of social movement focused on happiness and well-being and mindfulness and all these concepts that we share a passion for. I was, as you said, originally a kind of engineer scientist, and then went into the world of commercial sort of consulting and spent many years advising financial services companies and other organizations on strategy and technology and various other important sounding and deeply stressful things. But you know, despite this sort of outward appearance of success and, I guess, you know, academic credentials and so on, I guess I discovered to my shock that I'd been sort of, well, the metaphor I use is chasing up a ladder really, really fast without ever really knowing what the ladder was leaning against. And that kind of, you know, been part of my educational sort of striving, and then it became part of my work striving. And I guess I was always trying to succeed and please others, but I was never really tuned into what really made me happy and indeed what really motivated me. And I discovered actually just about before I had some kind of major breakdown, I think actually, that my life was off track. So I was, in quotes, successful and, you know, on many measures, you know, people would say I had a great life. I was, you know, pretty well paid for what I did. But certainly not rich, and you know, had a responsibility and kind of seemed to be doing well. But actually, what I was doing wasn't really connecting with me. I was, you know, feeling actually almost a conflict with my values in the context of this commercial world. And I felt like I was wearing two sort of different hats, really. There was the real me, the kind of person that has always been fairly happy-go-lucky and friendly and caring, I think. And then there was the sort of workplace me, who was actually, with hindsight, really rather nasty person, or at least rather boring, dry, sort of not very human, very kind of driven, and more focused on the process than the people. So I actually, what brought me to this whole topic first, and indeed to mindfulness, which you said has obviously had an impact on all of you, was an experience of really quite extreme back pain. This is now going back perhaps 12 years or so, certainly a decade or so. And I had this very, very severe episode of back pain that started off, you know, I was feeling like it had been a bit of an injury. But after 2 years of this chronic pain, I'd been to see all kinds of specialists and was asking what's going on with, you know, why I can hardly get out of bed sometimes. I'm in this terrible pain. This was alongside this very stressful commercial job. And you know, all kinds of conventional medical diagnoses told me I had a knackered spine and I had a degenerative spinal condition and all these really quite scary things. And nothing worked, no treatment, no kind of, I mean, injections, no other things was working. But my wife, who was clearly one step further on the journey to enlightenment than I was at the time, was training to be an osteopath. And she said, look, here's a book that could be useful. It's called, I think it was something like Mind Over Back Pain or Back Sense or something like that. But it basically said, look, a lot of what causes pain in back pain is caused by tension, actually. And a lot of tension, real physical pain tension, is caused by psychological pain. And in fact, what I discovered was that my really bad experiences of pain were triggered by this enormous amount of stress I was carrying and not talking about. I was being a classic British male, really, of caring, you know, deeply what other people thought of me and really striving and wanting to succeed and working really hard, but actually not really talking about my feelings and recognizing that I was actually in a bad place and being able to talk about that. So this was coming out physically. So this amazing thing happened where this book helped me realize this and changed my lifestyle. And one of the first things I did was to learn these breathing exercises, which I now realize are mindfulness exercises. But of course, I'm not even sure I'd ever heard the word mindfulness at the time, but started practicing these sort of breathing and relaxation exercises. And it just changed my life. I genuinely went from being unable to walk or get out of bed a number of times a week and being in constant pain to being pretty much pain-free within about 3 weeks. It was unbelievable. And this kind of the engineer scientist in me was like, this doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, why, what's happened here? And it just opened up a whole new beginning of a journey for me, which has ultimately led me to actual happiness. So I left the commercial world and I went off to retrain. I went to do this MBA that you mentioned, which was, I think for me, it was sort of, I want to go off and do something else different to consulting, maybe work in a different industry. At that time, I didn't really know what it was. But I discovered in that MBA that I didn't really care for selling people things they didn't need. No commercial industry really interested me. What I really wanted to do was do something socially useful. And I'd spent actually most of my working life doing things that were motivated by other things, you know, helping companies make more money and so on. So I initially moved to an area that was deeply passionate for me about climate change and sustainability and worked in that area for some years and found that really motivating, but discovered along that journey, as I continued to change and evolve as a person and had a family and got married and you know, realised that actually this happiness narrative was so important to me personally, but also everything I was reading about the science of well-being and about what really mattered was starting to have a very profound impact. And I recognise it in my passion for sustainability and saving the planet. Actually, you know, the biggest challenge we face as humanity is our belief that progress is tied to, you know, perpetual economic growth and consumption of stuff. You know, we've got a modern world which is about, you know, progress is about earning more and consuming more and having more. And that isn't just killing the planet, it's actually killing us. It's leaving us feeling, you know, just trapped and anxious and disconnected. And so actually for me, I realized that my calling actually, and I would say that quite seriously, is a feeling that as a genuine, you know, this is sort of like if you can find something that is your life's purpose, if you like, this is the kind of sense I got of here's something that I really care about and would like to change. It's this sense of actually a good life doesn't need to cost the earth and doesn't need to be about consuming and earning and striving. It's actually about a sort of calmer and more authentic version of the good life, which is about being connected with who you really are, having positive connections to others, having a sense of purpose and meaning. So I discovered all these things amazingly about the same time that three rather fabulous influential people had decided they wanted to start a movement on this theme. It wasn't yet called Action for Happiness, but we met and talked and I had the privilege and opportunity to sort of come aboard and launch this thing. So I'll happily tell you as this conversation progresses all about what we've been up to, but I guess that's what got me to this amazing privileged position of being able to launch and run this movement. But it's obviously a bit of a journey for me, and you know, not an obvious starting point really.
Was there any negative reactions to this change in career path?
That's a great question. So one of the strange things was, well, I thought I'd be, well, I'm not sure actually. I mean, I guess what I discovered was that one of the aspects of my character that had been, I guess, a great asset in my career, this desire to, or ability to kind of please others, if you like, and to succeed in their eyes, was a real challenge for me, because actually here was a topic I was passionate about. But I knew, both instinctively and also when I spoke to people, that many of my contemporaries, certainly peers in my working life, but also friends and indeed my own wife and parents and so on, probably thought that the idea of me leaving a secure job that I liked and was quite good at, this was the climate change related work, to pursue a happiness initiative that was fairly, you know, sketchily formed out at that stage, seemed like a bit of a crazy thing to do. You know, what on earth is this all about? Has Mark lost the plot? And so I stuck with it. And the reason I stuck with it, actually, this is an extra step I'd just like to bring in. I'd met an interesting guy called Neil Crofts, who wrote a book called Authentic, maybe about a decade ago. And Neil had come up with this interesting theory that we can all find our purpose in life if we ask ourselves three questions. And the three questions are quite interesting. The first is, what are you really talented at? Your actual strengths. The second was, what are you really passionate about? Which is subtly different, because often the things we care about are not the things we're best at, and vice versa. And the third question, perhaps even more interestingly, was, what sort of makes you angry? What would you like to change in the world? And his argument was, if you can answer these three questions authentically and combine your answers, then actually you can find your purpose in life. And I love this idea. So I went through that process and answered those questions and came up with a rather badly worded statement that said, look, I want to use my talent for organizing things and managing complex projects and motivating people, and my passion for this idea of what really makes for a happy life, not a rather inauthentic consumption-based view of the good life, but a deeper, more meaningful thing. And what I wanted to do was address this big sort of problem we have in modern society, that we've got our priorities wrong. So I wrote this down and got rather excited about it, but then thought, you know, how on earth can I ever pursue this? And then came across Richard Layard and these other founders who were wanting to make this happen. And I knew actually in my heart, that even though my wife was saying, why would you do this? And my parents were worried it was a crazy move, and my friends laughed in many cases. Because I'd come to that process, I had the conviction to say, no, I am going to do this, because it's something that's clearly, you know, so important to me. And actually what I discovered through that was the liberation of letting go of caring what other people think of me. It was the beginning of another important phase for me. I'd spent so much of my life wanting to please, and now I was doing a job where at least half the people I met thought I was a bit mad, and thought it was kind of funny. And actually, that, instead of killing me, that actually became something I was fine with, actually, and was pleased to discover that, you know, that was, I was at peace with that. So that's kind of how this all began.
Yeah, and so the action for happiness part of it.
Yeah, so the central idea with Action for Happiness, as you hopefully detected in coming to our events, is to bring together a movement of people from all walks of life that have this shared sense that happiness really matters. It's actually far from being a fluffy, trivial, trite, hedonistic notion. It's kind of actually what deep down we all want most for ourselves and also for our loved ones. When you ask parents what they most want for their children, the most common answer is, well, I kind of just really want them to be happy. And actually, when we reflect on what we want for our society, actually the best measure of progress is surely the society where the most people are able to live happy and meaningful and fulfilling lives, and the fewest possible numbers of people are struggling with anxiety, depression, unhappiness, isolation, and so on. So that conviction, that sense that happiness matters, is what drives Action for Happiness. And really, there are a number of levels it operates. At the first level, it's a very personal thing. It's really, how do I find practical ways to live a happy life and contribute to the happiness of others around me? But it's also a sort of social conviction to say, actually, we should be working together to try and create a happier society. That means the way we treat others in our neighbourhoods. It means how we behave in our workplaces. It means what we vote for in our politicians. It's sort of, you know, everything we prioritise. So within the actual happiness community now, we have tens of thousands, actually maybe even hundreds of thousands of people now that share that conviction in different ways and are putting that into practice in different ways. We have teachers applying, you know, the science of happiness in their classrooms. We have your parents adopting sort of positive parenting techniques to try and, you know, enhance the emotional well-being of their own families. We have business leaders trying to create happier workplaces because they know that that not only is better for their people, but also improves productivity. We have healthcare workers trying to take a different approach to sort of mental and physical well-being in a holistic sense. And we have policymakers thinking differently about policies on employment and education and other things. So we certainly don't have all the answers, and we're far from being on track to a genuinely happier society. But I'm really excited about where we've got to so far with the level of enthusiasm and conviction that people have got for this.
Yeah. I mean, as a teacher, I'm actually very grateful, very thankful for the fact that the organisation exists at all, and to sort of point my students in that direction, that there is an alternative to, as you mentioned earlier, sort of this consumption lifestyle that we all thought meant success. If as long as I've got as much money, I can make as much money as possible, and I'm deemed successful. But actually, that there's a movement, and it's that people actually think, well, perhaps we're heading down the wrong road, and that it would ultimately not lead us to the fulfillment. It's a hoax, as Alan Watts, we always quote, yeah, don't we? Says, you know, at the end of it, it's a big hoax, and
you've been duped.
Yeah. And so I'm very glad that I can actually point towards and tell them that, you know, beyond what the mainstream media would define as happiness, if you can search a little deeper. And what I like is also that there are practical ways to do so. I mean, it's a positive movement for the greater good of society, but on a personal level, that it's backed up by science, which I really like. So it's not just sort of an abstract philosophy, if you like, mm-hmm, but it's actually a very modern take on what is the good life.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, because it's always really encouraging to hear people sort of deploying these ideas in real world situations, because, you know, we can talk about these in conceptual terms, but actually, you know, taking this into a classroom is about one of the most important things you can do, because we know that the emotional health of young people is a far greater predictor of their lifelong well-being than their academic achievements and, in fact, their behaviour and other things. And yet we have an education system that seems to have its priorities upside down as well, which is, you know, turning schools into exam factories and leaving out this opportunity to help young people develop character and resilience and skills for a good life in the wider sense. So I'm really grateful to you for bringing it into that environment and for passing on that feedback. And as you say, this is a really important shift around the scientific evidence that's happened. So happiness, of course, has been in the realm of philosophy and spirituality and religion and, to some extent, grandmotherly wisdom for millennia. And only in about the last 15 years or so have we really had an empirical evidence base from science to sort of both challenge and back up that. So what we find is quite a lot of the ancient wisdom stacks up quite well when you look at through the lens of modern science. But indeed also, there are other things we learn that perhaps we couldn't say with certainty before. And so, yes, as you say, although there aren't any 10 commandments for happiness, there's no single magic ingredient. What we do now have is a framework that allows us to make better decisions. And also, when we've got people we care about, that we can think about their well-being and the way we treat them through that lens. So our 10 keys to happier living, which you'll find on actionforhappiness.org, are not 10 commandments, but they're all factors that have come from this research base and are things that generally have a really positive impact on people's mental and psychological well-being. And also, crucially, they're things that are within our control. So lots of things, of course, affect our happiness. You know, the level of equality and safety in our society is a great example. We can't necessarily change that. But what we can control is how we approach our relationships, whether we stop and notice the world around us, how we react to adversity, you know, how we look after our physical health and see that connection between that and our mental health, whether we kind of seek out opportunities to help others and be part of something bigger, how we treat ourselves, whether we have this sense of self-acceptance rather than beating ourselves up the whole time. These are all things that are shaped by our genes and our environment to some extent, but actually they're things that we have control over. And the really empowering finding from the science of happiness is that a huge proportion of what determines the difference in happiness between people comes from our conscious choices. Our genes, of course, have an effect, as does the environment, but actually we each have the power to make a difference through the way that we choose to live and the way that we choose to treat other people. And that's really exciting, and I kind of wish that someone had told me that when I was at school.
And that's the acronym is the Great Dream, right?
That's right. So Great Dream, the 10 letters of that acronym are the titles of the 10 keys. Mm-hmm. So we could certainly talk about some of the things within that.
So the first five, I like the way you group them together. You mentioned that the first five represent the...
Well, we talk about them as being the first five sort of habits that you can sort of do on a daily basis in the outside world that sort of have an impact on your inner well-being. And that these are certainly the five that are more readily doable on a day-to-day basis. So the first is giving. So we know that when we help others, it doesn't just help them, it also helps our own well-being. We are kind of wired to care about each other. And the same pleasure centres in our brain that light up when we do things for ourselves also light up when we help others. Mm-hmm. The second is relating and our relationships. Probably the single most important external factor of our happiness is our connections to other people. We are such a social species. And these epidemics of isolation and loneliness are so toxic for our well-being. The third is exercise, and this sort of idea of physical activity being so important, not just for our physical health, but for our mental health as well. The fourth is what we call appreciating, but really it's about mindfulness. It's about being able to notice and be in the moment. And I'm sure you've had other podcasts on the theme of mindfulness, but certainly we'd love to come back to that topic as well. And the fifth is this idea of learning through life, not just learning in an academic sense, but trying out new things day to day. You know, when we take new approaches, when we walk a different way to work, when we learn something new, when we meet someone new, all of that is sort of expansive and helps us grow and expands what we call our behavioural flexibility, our desire and ability to make new connections. So those are all things we can do sort of day to day. Those are the first five of the keys.
That's nice. I was listening to the Dalai Lama, actually, because Guillaume mentioned to me that Action for Happiness is actually patroned by...
Yeah, he's a patron for the Action for Happiness group.
That's right. Yeah.
So
we'll come back to that, Mark. We'll come back to that because that's a big one.
It's such an amazing honour, and we only recently had the opportunity to announce. But it's absolutely the case, and we're delighted that to have that connection with the Dalai Lama.
The point I was making was I actually went onto YouTube and I carried on watching a couple of talks of his. And he had a discussion with four or five other scientists with regards to neurosciences. And when he spoke about our interconnectedness, he referred to when we see pain, or someone going through pain, getting stabbed, you know, by a pen or whatever, you feel the pain. You also feel that pain. It's like when you're watching a video, you see someone falling over, you know, on their face, and you feel it on your face. Mm-hmm. But obviously your pain receptor, your face isn't telling you that pain is... You know, that's not your pain, so you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. It actually comes from something they now refer to as mirror neurons.
That's it, mirror neurons, yeah.
It's fascinating how that was found, actually. There was an Italian research lab where they had monkeys wired up with sort of probes on the brain to measure electrical activity. And there'd been some nuts in the lab where the monkeys were eating these nuts. And there was one of the researchers walked into the lab and picked up one of these nuts and ate it. And it so happened that the monkey was still wired up to the machine, and they noticed that the same part of the monkey's brain that lit up when it ate the nut itself lit up when it saw the human eat the nut. And they were like, what's going on here? This was the beginning of a discovery of the fact that we actually have part of our new sort of neural makeup is this ability to see behavior and activity in others, and sort of that same circuitry fires in our own brain. We are really wired to connect and care and have empathy for each other, which is really powerful, and it makes a lot of evolutionary sense, but it clearly is also the basis of Dalai Lama and many other people's, you know, great belief that compassion and, you know, connection are so vital for humanity.
The other point I found really interesting about what he was saying was for instance, people with phantom arms or missing limbs, if they experience that pain, or they see someone going for a pain on their arm and they have a missing arm, they actually feel that pain, the physical pain. Mm. So it's saying that the only thing that's separating the connection is actually our bodies. Mm. Otherwise, if we don't have that connection there, or our limb's missing, we actually feel the pain. So it's in the field around, which was quite an interesting point, I found.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, the whole aspect of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and indeed other Buddhist monks working with sort of Western science, I think, is a fascinating initiative. In fact, something called the Mind and Life Initiative was actually a collaboration between the Dalai Lama and Matthieu Ricard and a few other Buddhists and some of the leading neuroscientists. And what they've really shown is that there's such amazing scientifically demonstrable benefits from many of these traditional practices, in particular meditation. So, someone else we know well and is coming back to speak at one of our events later this year is Matthieu Ricard, who has been referred to in the media often as the world's happiest man. It's not a title he would use himself because he's a very modest and humble man, but he, when put into an MRI scanner and asked to carry out his sort of loving kindness and compassion meditations, he is off the chart compared to any other, you know, human being that the neuroscientists have measured in terms of activity in those areas of the brain associated with compassion and joy and positive emotions. And, he can almost turn that on at will when he goes into a sort of meditative practice. So we can't all be Buddhist monks and we can't all necessarily develop those same practices to the same extent. But what that demonstrates is this amazing, what's called neuroplasticity, this ability to actually change not just the function and behavior in our brains, but the structure of our brains over time, even as adults. We've always known that young people and children in particular, you know, their neural circuitry is still evolving and changing as they grow up. But even as adults, you know, the way we choose to use our minds changes the structure and function of our brains. And so this is why mindfulness and other techniques have such an amazing transformative potential.
And do you think it's because of this, I guess, because this scientific research is pretty new, isn't it? And I think that, and because of that, in combination with, you know, the Action for Happiness group, there's, the argument is a lot stronger now. We now have this, you know, we have the brain scans.
Sorry. I think we just need to be a little bit careful that we are still talking about a relatively emerging field of science. So the fields of affective neuroscience, which is about sort of neuroscience of emotions, and positive psychology, which is about looking at the psychology of how flourish rather than how to fix illness and deficits. Those are both relatively new areas, and you know, we've been looking at many facets of physical health for decades and decades and have an amount of research, and we're really only at the beginning of that journey. So I'm actually really excited about where we might be in 20 years time, even, about, you know, our knowledge of how the mind works and how our emotional systems work. And one of the lovely sort of metaphors that came up at one of our Action for Happiness events, I'm not sure if you were there when we had Meng from Google giving a talk, but he's this wonderful sort of mindfulness expert and generally all-round inspiring human being at Google, who's developed this program called Search Inside Yourself. Yeah. Google's obviously a pioneer in search generally, but this is about sort of inner searching and practicing, you know, emotional intelligence and mindfulness. But the metaphor that Meng used was that, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, we didn't really scientifically know the benefits of physical exercise or physical health. The idea that if you went to the gym and did some bicep curls or you went running, that that would change your physiology and it would change your musculature and it would change your physical health was quite new, really new. I mean, the army was starting to discover it, but we, you know, the idea of going to a gym, working out, just didn't really exist in the same way there. So if you think of how much we've revolutionized our approach to physical health in the last few decades, Meng was arguing that, you know, in 20 years' time, it will be just as normal to talk about how we look after our minds and emotions, you know, going for a mental workout in the same way that we go for a physical workout. It'll be actually second nature in a corporate environment, in our healthcare settings and so on. And again, I found that really exciting because it's just been completely missing from Western culture in recent years.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm just a bit excited about that because that's the direction that we want to head with our, well, I guess, you know, along with the Renaissance, along with Invest in Your Mind as well, we're looking at heading in that direction as well.
Well, you're pioneering this stuff. It's great.
Well, yeah, we want to give it a go. We want to use, because basically I studied a couple of years of neurolinguistics, so using a lot of techniques from that as well as mindfulness and yeah, always picking up things along the way and being so blessed to be able to sit and speak to people like yourself.
I was,
yeah.
Yeah. So, mentioning Matthew Ricard, I was talking to G earlier about one of his TED Talks, and when he talks about how the French intellectuals or some of the critics at the time didn't like the fact that he had published a book about happiness, which I found interesting because I thought everyone should, you know, it's self-evident that that's important, or at least to us. But actually, to hear him say that, you know, it was received with some criticism, this dirty word of happiness, as he says. I mean, and I think, well, without this, like, you know, the unexamined life, as the Greeks, the Greek philosophers said, I think that, again, you know, going back to the idea that if you fail to pay any attention to what is important in life, to what is the good life, and you put your priorities wrong, I think you know, back to the idea of the journey itself, where life's journey, where you end up, and how eventually it could lead to down the road that you hadn't imagined.
I mean, I think you're raising a really important point here in referring to that Matthew Ricard example, because it. And I'm glad you say that it's sort of like, you know, it's a surprise that people would have a problem with happiness being important. But of course, we run into this all the time with actual happiness, a combination of sort of misunderstanding and sort of bias caused by cultural factors leads people to have very adverse reactions to happiness. And I mean, I spent a long time debating why that is. And there's certainly in the UK, a certain amount of Britishness about, you know, not being very comfortable talking about emotional things, that comes into it partly. But I think there were three very real and important reasons why some people have an issue with talking about happiness, and it's really important to address these. So the first is that somehow modern culture has made happiness a slightly frivolous thing, that it's about sort of smiling gleefully all the time, and it's happy because I've eaten some cake, or, you know, it's happy because the sun's shining today. And of course, these things are nice, and moment to moment, good feelings are really important. But what we're really, really talking about with happiness, as Matthew Ricard himself said, is it's more than a fleeting emotion. It's a sort of optimal state of being. This is kind of beyond the moment to moment experience of emotion. So I think we need to help people recognize that we're talking about that deeper sense of happiness, perhaps more in the sense you referred to the Greek philosophers, more in the sense that Aristotle would have meant when he talked about, you know, life well lived, a meaningful life. And indeed, in the way that, you know, many of the great Enlightenment philosophers talked about, you know, this sort of great, you know, societal need to promote human happiness and well-being, Bentham and other, you know, philosophers that pursued that. But I think to come back to the reasons why people have problems with happiness, another one is that there's a sense that we're somehow saying that it's wrong to be unhappy. That, you know, a focus on happiness is about excluding negative emotions. And actually, that couldn't be further from the truth, because what you discover as soon as you look underneath the surface is that happiness is about, you know, an overall good experience of life, which includes the roller coaster of experiences we have. And we all face loss and adversity and horrible things happening in our lives, and which, you know, anger and sadness and frustration are natural and important reactions to those things. So happiness is not about denying negative emotions, it's about dealing well with the difficult situations. It's about sort of like a resilience or a sense of, you know, balance in responding constructively to the stuff that happens that goes wrong and will always go wrong. So that's another kind of misconception. And the final one, which I think I'm even more passionate about, is this sense that happiness is somehow a selfish thing, that by caring about happiness, I'm only interested in me. It's a hedonistic, individualistic thing. And in many ways, that's, you know, what people have a problem with modern society. It's become so me. Surely the pursuit of happiness is exactly the problem, you know, this is what Coca-Cola is telling us, that happiness comes from opening a fizzy drink, and, you know, people are upset because they want to be happier on Facebook and they want people to think that they're happy. And I quite agree with that. I mean, that sense of chasing a naive, superficial happiness is a great source of unhappiness. So, again, what we find when we look at this is real lasting happiness comes not from a selfish pursuit, but from caring deeply about others. And in fact, though people who are genuinely happiest are more pro-social, more caring, more sort of involved in their communities. So real happiness is anything but selfish. It's about being connected and being caring and compassionate. And so I think if we can break through those myths that happiness is frivolous, that it's about, it's, you know, ignoring negative emotions and it's about being selfish, then I think we get to the heart of this, which is a much richer and deeper sense of a good life.
Mm-hmm.
So we watched quite a few YouTube videos of yourself and the Action for Happiness in preparation for this, and a couple on BBC, and I noticed that Lord Richard Layer often appears too. You know,
yeah.
When you're both on stage, you've got a great, I like the way you guys kind of bounce off each other.
Thank you.
So can you explain a bit about who he is, your relationship with him, and his contribution to happiness and mindfulness in government? It's an area that we kind of wanted to find out a bit more about.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad you asked, because Richard's a bit of a hero of mine, really. So, in fact, one of the things that first woke me up to this whole area was reading his book called Happiness, Lessons from a New Science in about 2004. I was sort of in the process of getting myself out of this commercial life, and it really, really struck me as here's a profound thing. Here's an economist saying we should be measuring progress, not in economic terms, but in terms of human happiness. And he is really the person that's most behind the Action for Happiness movement, in that it came from people writing to him when he wrote that book saying, we'd love to take your ideas forward in some way. Have you ever thought about creating a movement? So that's where his first thinking on this came from. So I've had the great privilege of working with Richard for the last sort of 4.5 years on this. But he, you know, for a lot much longer than that, has been such a leading figure. So he started giving talks as well as writing this book on this topic, and has been incredibly influential in policy terms. And I think he can take great credit for two major things that have happened in the UK in particular, and certainly some globally as well. But in the UK, he has been the driving force that led to the government now measuring national well-being. So whatever you think about the current government, we now have a British government or a system in the UK where hundreds of thousands of people every year are surveyed about their levels of happiness and well-being, their levels of anxiety, the sense of meaningfulness in their lives, alongside all these conventional indicators of health and wealth and housing and so on. We now have a sense of some of these subjective measures of what really matters about people's emotional experiences of life. And that's really unique. Now, that data is not being used enough yet by policymakers, but the fact that we're capturing it is amazing, and thanks actually largely to Richard making that case inside government. He's also then used some of that kind of thinking to change our policy on healthcare. So he was instrumental in huge amounts of money being invested into provision of treatment for people struggling with depression and anxiety on the health service. We had very patchy support for that previously, and although things are far from perfect, a lot more focus in the health service is now on how to help deal with mental health issues as well as physical health issues. So, you know, Richard has been tirelessly working behind the scenes on influencing policy, as well as, you know, being quite a leading figure in the public domain around happiness. You mentioned his kind of impact with mindfulness. One of the interesting things he's been partly involved with is helping to introduce recently mindfulness courses into Westminster. So I think now about 100 parliamentarians, that's MPs and Lords, have now done, you know, really good in-depth mindfulness courses. And, you know, whilst we'll never, of course, expect to see the effect of that overnight, I think that's a really substantial opportunity for change in this country, which is when you see people that influence huge aspects of what happens in our society starting to become more mindful. Yes. They're not only going to be able to deal better with the stress and challenges in their own lives, they will be able to make more compassionate and wise decisions and let go of their ego and their, you know, political motivations to some extent, and hopefully make decisions more motivated by what's best for society. And I think that's, you know, something I'm really hopeful about, that we can see some cultural change by getting this onto the agenda of our leaders. I don't know if you saw, but at Davos, the World Economic Forum recently, Jon Kabat-Zinn was there giving morning mindfulness sessions for all these, you know, high-profile business leaders and political figures. Now, on one hand, you might say, well, that's all well and good for the rich and privileged. But actually, it's the rich and privileged who so often have got a completely skewed conception of what really matters. Mm-hmm. And actually, if these people can start to see the world differently and more compassionately, that gives me great hope for better decision-making and better leadership in future.
Yeah. One of the common points that both yourself and Lord Richard Layard bring up is that although the GDP and the economy has done so well over the past 50, 60 years, the actual levels of happiness haven't followed in that trend. Is it something you could perhaps speak to that a bit?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably that if you had to pick a single defining fact that underpins all the things we care about, it is that kind of travesty that you've just said, really, which is we put so much effort into growing our economies, you know. And, you know, many of the austerity cuts and terrible things that are being brought through in the UK at the moment are primarily motivated by making sure that we maintain economic growth at all costs. And of course, huge amounts of the things that caused the economic situation we've been in for the last sort of 6 to 8 years was you know, deregulation and other, you know, desires to boost short-term growth that actually led to, you know, an unstable situation. So we're so obsessed with this, you know, what's the economy doing? It's on the top of every news broadcast. It's at the centre of every political speech. And yet, when you look over the last 60 years in modern developed economies like the US and the UK and others, you see, at best, a sort of plateauing, a flatlining of happiness. So we have literally got richer but no happier. And, you know, there are all kinds of complicated reasons for that. One of which is the very famous hedonic treadmill effect, which is that, you know, as we become better off, we, you know, just acclimatise to our new spending power, and what seemed exciting initially becomes, you know, second nature, and we sort of adapt to our circumstances. So more wealth and stuff doesn't necessarily bring more happiness. But there are also other, of course, social factors that have undermined the benefits of a better economy, or at least a larger GDP. And of course, inequality in income is a major one. Breakdown in trust is one that I always think is so frightening. So in the 70s, about 60% of people in the UK said most other people could be trusted. Mm. Now that figure's about half that much, about 30%. You know, we've seen a kind of halving in levels of social trust in a few decades. And that's terrible. It's shocking. And it's in many ways driven by a combination of our commercialized media and our cynical and fear-mongering sort of news media. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's something that we need to question, which is, you know, if our priority should be really as a society to improve human well-being, then we've really failed at that for 60 years. And actually, our mission with Action for Happiness is to say, how can we inspire action that puts that right to some extent? How can we create both the policy change to make better decisions as leaders, but also how can we have the cultural change where people care more about each other, where people are more trusting, where people are act in ways that promote collective happiness, not just sort of individual happiness.
Yeah, so the collaboration with the UN for the International Day of Happiness that took place last year, that's definitely a huge stepping stone to exactly what you're just talking about. How did that come about?
Yes, it is and it isn't. So it came about in a really exciting way because a number of sort of influential figures, including the Bhutanese government, and Bhutan is famously a country that decided to put gross national happiness as its measure of progress. In some ways, it's a slightly unhelpful example because Bhutan is such a uniquely different country to, you know, the sort of Western democracies we're talking about. So it's not exactly comparable. But basically, for whatever reason, there came to the point where the UN had this remarkable conference on happiness and well-being, which I was at, back in 2012, I think it was, which sort of started this process of saying that we need a paradigm shift in thinking about progress in terms of happiness and well-being, not just growing the economy. So the fact that you know, even happened was remarkable, and that's led to this sort of annual production of a World Happiness Report, which Richard Layard, our co-founder, is one of the authors of. And in fact, the next World Happiness Report comes out this May, so we're going to sort of see an update on how different countries are doing. It's hugely influential in that we're now having a comparable set of analysis of how countries are doing with a different set of benchmarks. So we're now saying, actually, you know, when it comes to happiness, the Northern European countries like Denmark and Holland and Sweden do amazingly well. And actually some of the economically successful countries, Singapore, the US, and others, aren't necessarily scoring as well when it comes to human happiness. That's interesting and important. But the reason I said it is and it isn't, you know, at the end of the day, this is still a sideshow when it comes to world affairs, sadly, compared to you know, many other topics that are dominating developments. And it will be, you know, what we really need to see is this becoming more centre stage. And one opportunity that could be important is that Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, is very interested in this measurement of well-being idea. And there's a chance that when she is president of the G8, which is going to be quite soon, I believe, that she may well actually bring this in as a topic for a discussion at sort of G8 level, which would be, you know, incredibly
very good.
Powerful. So, you know, amazing, we can never predict how these things will go, but the fact that Richard Laird has met her a number of times and she really shares this conviction that we should be thinking about progress in a different way. And that's, so I think she could be a really influential person in terms of taking this there's the sort of political side of the sword. But we need cultural change too. It's, you know, we can't leave this in the hands of politicians, and indeed politicians are often a great source of unhappiness. So we need the movement, the mass movement of people that really care about the shift in values. So that's why we're really trying to mobilise day-to-day people, whoever they are, parents, teachers, you know, people in their daily lives, to say that we can each make a difference. We can each not only affect their own happiness, but we can, you know, we can do little acts of kindness. We can connect with others. We can bring more happiness to our workplaces and our streets.
I thought it was nice as well when you know, I was watching your talk, and I think you mentioned that someone did a good deed on that day. You know, helped a lady out with her bicycle. You know, just was that you?
It was me, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's good. I thought
it wasn't me that was helped out, but it was me telling that story at the
end. Yeah, that's right, that's right. Yeah, I thought that was a really nice story as well. I mean, you know, just to think that, you know, that changed one person's life, and then it's just that ripple effect, really, that you want to create. So you're throwing out those stones into the pond.
Well, let me give you a story that has left me really moved recently.
Okay.
So one of the things we've created with Action for Happiness, what we've realised is that all these ideas we've talked about are really important, and you can learn about them online, and you can read, and you can explore them for yourself. But the real magic happens when you connect together in groups, when you meet face to face, and when you have kind of conversations like this one. I mean, it's lovely talking to you guys and to see all your, you know, the sort of interest you have in this and the wisdom you have about it. But actually, it's these face to face or, you know, person to person connections where you really explore what matters. And so that's led us to create a course actually called just that. It's called Exploring What Matters. It's the Action for Happiness course. It's an 8-week course that I believe a couple of you guys are going to run.
Yeah, Anne and myself are going to be commencing that in March.
Yeah, it's
fantastic. So we've created a course that we've piloted ourselves a number of times, and we're now in the process of trying to roll out to our members so they can run this. So it isn't a sort of teacher to student course where you have to be an expert. It's really just, you know, somebody organises it and starts a conversation in a community group. So we've had sort of 20, 25 people coming together, although it can be a much smaller group, to talk about these topics. And each week of the 8-week course is a different big question, like what really matters in life, or what actually makes us happy, how can we cope when things go wrong, can we find fulfilment at work, what makes for happier communities. You know, all big questions that don't have right or wrong answers, really. But what you do in the group is you explore together, you watch a video, you learn a few facts, you share your own personal experiences, you then have an important conversation together as a group, and then you come away with action ideas for yourself and for others. Mm-hmm. And so we're really excited about this idea. But the story I was going to tell was that a lady called Jasmine came along to the course, and she had been struggling with chronic pain for many years. She had this unbelievable mixture of sort of fibromyalgia and a spinal disorder and ME and, you know, things and incidents and accidents that had left her in just constant pain. And she'd come across Active Happiness in a kind of online search, I think, and came to one of our events and ended up coming to this course. And so starting the course in a bad way, you know, she got involved with it and came out at the end, and a couple of light bulb moments happened for her. One was she discovered mindfulness, and so she saw the talk by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which was a live talk that he gave to one of our events, but it's also part of the course as well. And that helped Jasmine realise that she could have a different relationship with her pain, that actually she didn't have to be completely engulfed by it, and she could actually observe it rather than be brought down with it. So it didn't change the physical pain, but it changed her relationship with it and helped her feel incredibly better. Far from perfect and still a long way to go, but actually made a massive difference for her. But the other light bulb, even more inspiringly, was that later on in the course we were talking about, you know, our own purpose and fulfillment and what we try to do with our lives. And she realised that what she wanted to do was to help other people struggling with chronic pain. She wanted to use what she'd learned to help others. And so she now works to try and support people that have chronic pain and to share her experiences and to help them find more positive ways of dealing with their own problems. And so many of the chronic pain sufferers she knows, and her own experience was that the existing provision of pain management classes and so on really don't leave you feeling very hopeful. So what I love about the story, and I mean, her talking about it is far more inspiring than listening to me, but the beautiful thing that's happened there is the combined effect that we so often see and think is so important. So her own well-being changed. She became better able to deal with adversity in her life. But that didn't just stop there. She then said, oh, how can I help others? And that, I think, is the unique combination that we're looking for Action for Happiness. How do we help people live happier lives themselves, but also contribute to the happiness of others? And Jasmine's doing that. And, you know, hopefully many thousands of people are discovering that those two things are completely linked together.
So how can people find out more? Where do they go to?
Well, if you go to actionforhappiness.org, you can find out generally about the movement, but actionforhappiness.org/course, or if you just search for the Action for Happiness course, you'll find out about that. There's a video, there's some materials. We're just about to launch the ability for people to register to run the course. We've had 270 people from all around the country and indeed all around the world put themselves forward so far to say they'd like to run the course. We know there are many more who will apply as well. So we're really excited about hopefully getting hundreds of these courses up and running this year. And coming back to the Dalai Lama question, which you raised earlier, I mean, we're so delighted that he's agreed to be our patron. And what we're doing in September this year in London is having a big event where he will be speaking. And we will use that as an opportunity to sort of more publicly launch the course, and he will be hopefully endorsing it. And in fact, both Action for Happiness and the course are mentioned in the Dalai Lama's new book he's writing with...
Congratulations on that, that's fantastic.
So really excited about that. And it's just, I mean, the reason I think that he is connected with what Action for Happiness is doing, and it's thanks to Richard Layard who had that conversation with him, is because the Dalai Lama has a passion for what he would call secular ethics, this idea of leaving religion aside, how is it we can help people from all faiths and of no faith live a good life and an ethical life and a caring life? And, you know, this realization that we can be good people and compassionate people and caring people without a particular religious doctrine. And yet, as we've let go of religion in modern society to a large extent, we risk throwing out a lot of those timeless principles of caring for others. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think in many ways we're a secular movement, or indeed a movement that's open to people of all faiths and none, mm-hmm. that sort of embodies the Dalai Lama's principles of happiness and compassion without it being tied to, you know, these other dogmas and spiritual paths. And of course, you know, all the great religious traditions are fabulous at encouraging people to help others, mm-hmm. whether it's Christianity or Islam or anything else. But actually, modern Western culture, where the religion isn't there, is pretty bad at encouraging compassion and self-care as well. So what we're hoping to do is to reignite a sense of living a truly good and caring and altruistic life in the context of a secular society. And the Dalai Lama is really interested in that. So that will be a theme for this event. And indeed, we're hoping to be joined by many other fabulous speakers as well at that event. So Gus O'Donnell, who's been at the heart of He was the former cabinet secretary in the UK and has been the heart of UK government measuring well-being. Will hopefully be there to talk about the politics of happiness. Dan Goleman, the psychologist, will hopefully be there to talk about the psychology of happiness and the Dalai Lama's book, his vision for a happier world. Arianna Huffington, we're hoping, will be there as well, who runs the Huffington Post and is a great advocate of well-being. And also we're hoping that this great neuroscientist, Richie Davidson, the guy who's been putting all these Buddhist monks into MRI scanners, will also be joining us to talk about the neuroscience of happiness. So if you want to keep 21st of September, the Monday, free in your diaries, you might find that a good event to be at. Oh, yeah.
Definitely. So one last question. Where do you see Action for Happiness in 5 years?
That's a really great question, because I guess we're coming up to sort of almost a five-year mark now.
Exactly, yeah.
In many ways, I feel we've only scratched the surface and there's so much we'd love to do that we haven't done yet. You know, part of me thinks that, you know, a successful outcome, maybe not in 5 years, but in the future, is that we don't need Action for Happiness anymore, you know, because it's so self-evidently obvious that we should be living in a way that promotes our own and other people's happiness and well-being. But, you know, the idea of a movement for it is kind of, it is completely, you know, unnecessary. So a long-term vision is almost that we don't need to exist anymore because it's just part and parcel of the normal culture we've created. But of course, that's, you know, slightly lofty and wishful thinking in terms of where we're at as a society. And we need to be recognising we've got some major challenges in our world at the moment, and we're not trying to in any way undermine those or ignore those. But I think a practical aim for the next 5 years is to turn what's been a very successful online movement. So we've had, I think our sort of social media community now is 300,000 people, which is amazing. We've got 160 countries represented and so on. So the extent to which people have connected with this idea is quite extensive. Mm-hmm. But what we haven't done yet is really create enough of that face-to-face connection. So what I'm really excited about for the next 5 years is more face-to-face, real-world connection. You know, the online stuff is great and it's at the heart of changes in our society, but it's only when people meet face to face and talk in an authentic, genuine way that real change happens. And so one lovely example is our Brighton Action for Happiness group. which has now got, I think, about 800 people connected with it, which is remarkable. I was down there recently. Lovely group who run that there. Not only have they been meeting regularly and putting on events and doing outreach, they've created something called the Happy Cafe in Brighton. So they've taken over a sort of really nice cafe venue there every Saturday and sort of transformed it into Action for Happiness branded stuff. And they welcome people and share our materials. And basically anyone could come along and have conversations like this. And not only have they done that there, but you know, other cafes around the country have been inspired by this and are following suit. So in a couple of weeks' time, we'll be launching or hoping to launch the first Happy Cafe in London, the Canvas Cafe near Brick Lane. And we'll be actually running the Action Happiness course there. One of our team will be. And so we're hoping that as well as lots of these groups and courses happening around the country, that there'll be some physical venues where people can go and connect and meet other like-minded people. So we're hoping many other cafe owners and premises will be interested to sort of become part of this movement as well.
Brilliant.
Yeah, well, talking about the eight-week course that we intend on running ourselves, I mean, as a former participant, just like to mention, you know, my personal view on I think...
I've forgotten you'd done the course. In
Hackney, that's right, yeah.
Lucy and Tarly. Brilliant. Yeah, I'd love to hear your personal reflection.
Well, I think it's fantastic. And I think, you know, it's not giving up an evening because I thoroughly enjoyed it. But supposing someone was listening and thought, okay, could there be other things I could be doing in my evening? Then I think that it stays with you a lot longer than the 8 weeks. The tools and the techniques and just the memories of the people that you meet. As you said, you're quite isolated if you're looking at the happiness movement online, although, of course, it's a good way to spread it. Mm-hmm. But the face, you know, because we are deeply connected. It's the connection. So it stays with you a lot longer, and then you think, you know, of all the memories, of all the things that I spend an evening doing, you know, whether it be maybe... go out, see a few friends.
Like-minded people.
So you can spend an evening down the pub with your mates and, you know, you do the same thing. I suppose it's quite repetitive. And so this is something quite different, you know, spending every week for 8 weeks with like-minded people, as you said. And it stays with you a lot longer. I think it's worth investing your time. It's not a sacrifice. I think it's actually something you find it quite enjoyable, eye-opening, and ideas that you hadn't necessarily come across or had considered. So very practical and just great people. I have to say that the people...
Well, thank you for that. I'm really glad you found it useful. And that was my experience as well of being involved in it. And I helped to develop the materials. But I find it so inspiring to be able to lead one of those courses, and indeed to be able to participate, and because the leader is really a participant in the course as well. And I just found that it was one of the most inspiring things I've ever been involved with in terms of, you know, here we are, you know, we're so, especially British men, I don't want to generalise too much, but we spend so much of our time having sort of slightly shallow, flippant conversations about beer and football and whatever. And those things shouldn't be undermined in any way. That's part of our kind of fabric of our friendships and our relationships. But when you get together with people and have some authentic and interesting and funny, but also kind of quite profound conversations about what matters in life, it's rather different to so many other conversations we have. And it's very similar to these conversations you guys are having on these podcasts, which I hugely admire. And I think it's what you're doing is fantastic. But it's actually missing so often in our society. So, you know, hopefully if people listening to this decide to come along and either get involved in attending a course or maybe even run a course, then they'll discover that that is anything but a waste of time. It becomes some of the most valuable hours and some of the most memorable conversations. Certainly I'm still remembering the people and discussions that we had when I first did the course as well.
So all that information about how to take part, we're going to put in the information underneath the podcast. So
great, thank you.
So there'll be one local place where everyone can get all the details and stuff. So, you know, I hear you're a bit of a guitar player and singer, so we want to invite you to one of our karaoke nights that we do and host
great.
One.
Sounds good.
I see you're a bit of a guru on the guitar.
Not a guru, really. No, I used to play in. Yeah, I used to play guitar. In fact, I got my guitar out with a friend recently for the first time in ages. Doesn't have much time for it now. I have children, and we had a few beers and played the guitar week before last, and it was rather fun. But I sing in a community choir near where I live in Kingston, which is fun. We don't make a very good noise, but I do think there's something amazing. Music is one of those lovely things that connects people, and it taps into your inner creativity, but also helps you connect to others. Mm-hmm. And it's rather more emotional than cerebral, and it's just, yeah, I just love it. So I will happily join a karaoke evening. Just in, yeah, let me know when. I'll be there.
Beautiful. All right, well, first, and again, you know, congratulations and well done on, you know, the work that you've done in, I guess, spreading the word, you know, being that conduit, and, you know, with the work and the effort that you're doing,
it's very inspiring. Mm.
You know, help me get on the mindfulness path, which is going to be something that, you know, not only do I take with me moving forward, but it's going to be part of everything that I do.
Mm. You know, well, I'm really inspired to hear that, and I think what you guys are doing is fantastic. And we haven't talked about mindfulness that much actually in this conversation, mm-hmm. but I'm really encouraged to hear that you all, you know, meditate regularly. We often try and start actually having these meetings when we get the team together with a kind of, you know, sort of mindfulness thing together. And it's funny, I talk about this topic a lot, and it's something that's had a huge impact on my life. And I discovered at the start of this year that I had sort of let go of my daily practice of mindfulness, and actually that was suffering as a result. So I sort of reinstated that this year, and I found that's had a really powerful impact on my relationships, my sleep quality, my sanity generally. So you know, this stuff, it's easy to talk about these things, but actually the real change happens when we put it into practice. It's the action for happiness, not the talking for happiness, that really makes a difference. Yeah. So thank you, G and Anne and Fran, for inviting me here and for everything you're doing as well. So
absolutely, it's been a pleasure, and we'd love to have you, you know, once we finish the 8-week course, you know, we'd love to reach out to you again and maybe, you know, share another podcast of our experiences.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Great.
All right, well, have a lovely evening, and we'll speak soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye bye.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies, and a fly go a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We'll save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee, them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep pants, and all of a sudden you are say Indiana Jones.